Merely rich. In today's skewed wealth system, multi-billionaires don't need hard work and creativity. Their money does all the work to lift them above everyone else.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Dr. Paul Demanchuk is proud to support KMUD Radio. The Vision Center provides eye care and eyewear located at 616 H Street in Eureka. The Vision Center can be reached at 443-1619. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we have the Environment Show with Epic. You've got it tuned to Redwood Community Radio, KMUD, Garberville, Redway, 91.1 FM, KMUE, Eureka, Arcata, 88.1 FM, KLAI, Laytonville, 90.3, down on Shelter Cove at 99.5, and always on the web at kmud.org. The Environment Show coming up next.
And welcome to the Environment Show. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, the Executive Director of EPIC. And this is my first show of 2020, so welcome to a new year and welcome to a new decade. I have a busy show for us tonight. I have Paul Hughes from Forest Forever on. We're going to be talking about AB 1492, and you'll learn what AB 1492 is and what it did and what it doesn't do. Then Don Lipminson is going to be on. Don is a wildlife advocate based out of Mendocino County, and he's going to talk to us about wildlife services, what this archaic federal government agency that kills wildlife is doing in Mendocino County, and local activists' efforts to rein in wildlife services. And then Regina Cicizola is going to join me to talk about Trinity River water issues. So we have a packed show, but as always, you're welcome to call in. The line is 923-3911. And before I get going with my guests, I have one special announcement, which is EPIC is having a benefit concert at the Arcata Playhouse on February 5th. And it is featuring Axon Orchestra. Axon Orchestra is a world music gypsy jazz inspired ensemble featuring Fabrice Martinez on violin, Dusty Bro on guitar, and Miles J on stand up bass. Doors are at 6:30 with a dinner of hearty soup, salad, and locally baked breads available, along with drinks and desserts. Tickets will be available at the door on a sliding scale, and no one will be turned away. All drink proceeds will go to EPIC's mission of protecting and restoring California's forest ecosystems. And a special thank you to Fabrice Martinez because he has played numerous benefits for EPIC in the past. He's always a pleasure to see, and his current ensemble is fabulous and certain to please. So please put on your dancing shoes and come support EPIC. So first, I am joined by Paul Hughes. Paul, are you on the line?
I am, Tom.
Hey, give me a little introduction. Who are you exactly?
Good to be with you again. I'm the executive director of Forests Forever, which some of your listeners, maybe a lot of them, will remember is the organization that sponsored Proposition 130 in 1990, which became popularly known as the Forests Forever ballot measure. We came very close to victory in 1990, even though we were outspent about 6-1. And we're still around. We're doing advocacy work and have been for all those years. Now over 30 years, in favor of good bills and ballot measures and against bad ones. That's according to what we deem good or bad in the state of California concerning forest policy.
All right. And I would like to give a special thank you and shout out to Forest Forever because it is a somewhat lonely world working on private industrial forest land reform in California. And Paul and Forest Forever have been at it for a long time and are a special friend to EPIC.
Thank you, Tom. It's so good to, you know, you guys do a lot of litigation work and have had some landmark victories, and you're quite right. Working on private forest land issues is much more challenging than working on public, and I'm not taking away from those activists who've done great things on national forest lands, you guys included, but it is tough when you're fighting the private property values of American culture and to try to regulate logging and get it done right on private lands is an especially tough challenge.
And here on the north coast of California, private industrial forest lands make up just about the majority, I believe, of our total land ownership base. So mm-hmm. what goes on big industrial timberlands is very important. So So we're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about this bill that passed, what was it, in 2011 or 2012, AB 1492. So people get lost in this ABs and the numbers and whatever else. So what was this bill and what was it supposed to accomplish?
Well, Assembly Bill 1492, which became law in 2012, was the culmination of a long-term effort to assess cumulative watershed effects from logging on timberlands. And that's a big mouthful, so let me just back up and say a little about it. The landmark law that, as you know, regulates logging in California, we're talking here about on non-federal land, on private industrial and non-industrial timberlands, is the so-called Zeeburg-Nedgedly Act, or Forest Practice Act of 1973. And among its many provisions, one of the key things that it decreed is that when you're doing logging on your land, you need to submit a timber harvesting plan that describes the cut, the slope, the weather, the type of silvicultural practice you'll be doing. Will you be doing selection or clear cutting? What wildlife is there, especially listed species, and so on and so forth. And the timber harvest plan is supposed to also take into account the effects of your logging project on not only, say, the stream nearby based on the silt that your logging is going to wash into that stream, but also the effect of your project in concert with or in combination with projects like it that have already occurred in the watershed or are due to be reasonably foreseeable projects in the future. That together is called the cumulative effect of your project, because after all, it's not correct just to say that if my project is going to wash a ton of silt into the stream this month, that's the only impact on the fish when there are other projects that have already done that, continuing to put silt into the stream, or projects that are going to be putting more silt into the stream. You've got to take the whole picture into account. And the Zeeburg-Nedgedly Act said that cumulative watershed effects, the whole combination of projects in concert, need to be taken into account when I do logging. Unfortunately, though, in all those years since the Zeeburg Act became law, it has not accounted for cumulative watershed effects. We're talking here not only about silt, but the effects on the watershed from temperature, from effects on wildlife, such as listed species, spotted owls, marbled murrelets, soil productivity, biological resources, and even visual and recreational and traffic impacts caused by my project. It's the core of the Forest Practice Act, assessing cumulative watershed effects, and it has never been done even close to correctly. It has been talked about in the breach. It has never been meaningfully assessed. And in fact, the only form in a timber harvest plan that's supposed to take into account cumulative effects is a simple, basically one-page checkbox form in which the forester who's filling out the form is expected to just say, so will this timber project cause a significant cumulative effect or not? And if there's mitigation, will there still be a significant effect? And they almost always say, no, there won't be a significant effect even after mitigation. In fact, we only know of one case in which cumulative effects have been deemed to be significant after mitigation. There's only been one case in which the forester said, yes, there will still be significant negative cumulative effects from this project after mitigation. And that forester was fired once they filled out the form indicating that lingering negative effect. So the system is broken. The core provision of the Zeeburg-Nedgedly Act has not been carried out. It has been the subject of not only controversy but lawsuits, denied federal grants, and we want to finally get this assessment done correctly. And so Assembly Bill 1492 was the culmination of a long-term effort to get cumulative watershed effects done right.
So AB 1492 had a tax imposed.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how that tax was supposed to fund and was supposed to get after this issue of cumulative effects?
Yes. The core provision that most interested us in the conservation community, forestry reform community, was that it imposed a 1% tax on retail lumber products and engineered wood products and sold in the state of California. So when you buy a 2x4 in California after AB 1492 went into force, you would pay 1% of that toward a fund that became known as the Forest Timber Regulation and Forest Restoration Fund, a kit of money that came to, last time we looked, somewhere between $30 and $40 million per year, and was intended to provide money that would not only do some forest restoration, but much more importantly, would actually go to the heart of the matter that was causing the need for forest restoration and fix the regulatory process that was so broken or non-existent, leading to damaged watersheds and environmental impacts to begin with. What we need most is to first do no harm, and what the timber tax, lumber tax would do is fund a process by which we could actually develop meaningful regulations that could be efficiently, meaning financially, efficiently carried out and to have the maximum possible effect in giving us clean water and good wildlife habitat and other values. That was the key provision that that money was supposed to do. That was back in 2012. It's now been eight years going on, and it has not yet hit the mark on that.
So why hasn't it hit the mark? What in particular has failed? And I know that this has been a pet project of SOHUM superstar Richard Ginger to push for this pilot project system that would closely study timber effects and recommend changes. So something has gone wrong. And what was that thing that went wrong?
One of the principal things, as you mentioned, that came forth from 1492 that was supposed to get at this failure to measure cumulative watershed effects was a pilot project, which was to be established on a watershed in California. And it was envisioned to be the first of four pilot projects that would be done. And they would represent four different, ecologically different forested areas of the state. So there would be one on the North Coast, say, and another in the maybe the Modoc region, another in the Sierra Nevada and maybe the Central Coast, geographic spread like that. The first one that rolled out was Campbell Creek in the 10 Mile River watershed was chosen to be the watershed of focus for this very first pilot project. It rolled out in 2017. It was a two-year project wrapping up in 2019. And what its purpose was to assemble all the material that had been collected in that watershed surrounding timber harvesting over the many years and decades that harvesting had gone on. So Lime Lumber Company, the Lime Redwood, the timber company that owned the watershed, the Campbell Creek watershed, agreed to make all their timber harvesting data that they'd collated over the years available. And putting all that data together, copious amount of data, is important to try to get at some sort of congruency in the data. So, to go from a Tower of Babel situation like we've had up to now, where different nomenclature is used, say, to describe stream temperature, different methodologies are used to determine canopy cover, and all kinds of different ways of measuring and describing environmental effects could be brought together, and some commonalities of language and of data sets and of values could be developed from all that data that was studied in the Campbell Creek watershed, And from that, we'd come away with a common system that everyone agreed with. All the stakeholders would agree on the methodologies and the nomenclature and all used to develop regulations to improve environmental quality in the wake of logging or to prevent environmental impacts from logging. You had to bring all that together and make it make sense to all the stakeholders so we're all on the same page and not all using different values to describe what's going on. That's step one. Well, the pilot project in Campbell Creek failed to do that. It took 2 years. They didn't even completely finish their scope of work plan. And while they did some nice studies on various things that were interesting to learn about concerning wildlife and concerning the watershed, they did not develop the key thing that they were supposed to, which was a way of assessing and regulating cumulative watershed effects or even really getting a handle on how to start that. And that is the way you first do no harm, is to get at the core set of regulatory questions that are causing the problems in the first place. And it's well and good to go about spending millions of taxpayer consumer dollars on fixing this or that reach of a watershed that's been damaged. But what you're really doing is just cleaning up a mess that the timber companies should have prevented or have not caused to happen in the first place. And that really isn't the job of consumers and taxpayers, that we should be getting at a system of regulations that is meaningful, that is cost-effective, and is highly effective in getting at these environmental issues that flow forth from logging and preventing them happening in the first place. That was what it was supposed to do, and it did not get that done.
So it sounds like the wheels came off at some point, but that this underlying premise, this idea that we could come up with a shared language to describe the effects of logging is still a good idea. Is there a way that we could save AB 1492, save the pilot project?
You asked a moment ago, why did it go wrong? Well, I think the reason is, strangely enough, that the industry doesn't want to be regulated, really. They don't want to have these kind of meaningful regulations imposed, even if they're very cost-effective and streamlined, which is also a key objective of 1492. And when you have that situation, you have the industry not really wanting to be regulated, and you have an agency, CAL FIRE, that is really captured and has been for decades by the industry it's supposed to regulate, then the whole thing veers off course very easily, because the only people who want to really talk about the elephant in the room are the conservation advocates, and they are outnumbered. They are not paid full-time salaries to be there, to do their homework between meetings, to go to meetings week after week and year after year, the way agency staff and timber industry employees are. And so it's very hard to keep that situation on track when they don't want to discuss it. As far as what we need to do, as we move toward a second pilot project, and I think we need to insist that we stick with the plan and go to a second pilot project, we need first to collate the lessons that we learned from the first one, which, if you don't agree it failed, it certainly fell way short of the mark. We need to take the lessons from the first one, apply them to the second much more rigorously, with a much better adherence to timeline and to deliverables on that timeline by the team. There needs to be, in order to make that happen, a lot more public transparency and accountability, involvement by the public, not just in having comment opportunities, but having a real seat at the table in terms of managing the whole process going forward. And I would add as a sidebar to that, that one of the things that went wrong early on in the first pilot project is the Board of Forestry, the Resources Agency, I should say, established the so-called Effectiveness Monitoring Committee, which was an outgrowth of the Board of Forestry and its interests. And it essentially captured the ability to recommend to the Board of Forestry the outcomes of the pilot project. So it could act as a filter or as an editor and could even alter the recommendations that the pilot project might produce in an inappropriate way. And that effectiveness monitoring committee, which is not an independent body, it is not fully involving the public and the advocacy community, not to mention other stakeholders, is blocking the way and needs to be either eliminated or step aside in an appropriate way so that it doesn't get in the way of what 1492 is supposed to be accomplishing going forward.
So independence, that's one theme, that's one way that we could improve AB 1492 and its implementation, to have greater independence. And it also sounds, and this is somewhat related to independence, but to have greater scientific, not certainty is the right word, but to have scientists doing science and to have folks who are non-biased helping in the preparation of these things without some sort of a filtering committee.
Yes, exactly. And again, I would emphasize transparency and participatory management on the part of all stakeholders so that we don't just have basically the industry players and the agency players who are dancing to the same tune and have been allies for a long time, driving the process. It needs to be all-inclusive. That's the way we'll get a product out of this that we can all agree is going to accomplish the purposes that the Zeeberg-Nidgely Act intended. That needs to happen going forward, and we've got to insist on it now. This first experience has been very sobering. We fought for a long time to get cumulative watershed effects measured. There were three pieces of legislation sponsored by Senator Assemblymember Wes Chesbro that led up to 1492 that were all pulled offline. One was vetoed, and a couple of others fell by the wayside. And so we've worked for a long time to get this done. And it's holding back the health of our watersheds and all the economic and other values that flow from having healthy watersheds and salmon streams and so forth.
One of my concerns, and this is a self-reflection at EPIC, is we have had a decline in private industrial timberland litigation. And there it's multi-causal why that has occurred. But without that threat, without Cal Fire worrying about the Enviros bringing a new lawsuit and going up to the Supreme Court and getting forced to change the rules at the Board of Forestry, you know, and so on and so on and so on. One of my concerns is that without the threat of a stick, Cal Fire will not change, or the Board of Forestry will not change. And and in part, I don't really know what to do because the funding of the environmental movement has moved away from private forest land reform. As I said earlier in the show, you know, we are kind of odd ducks, EPIC and Forest Forever, because we focus on private forest land. And funders, and, you know, if there are any funders out there listening, this is a call to you now. Funders have moved away from this and have moved on to other issues. The time of the timber wars has ended, or we're on some sort of a detente or something. And so perhaps this is just a time for me to buck up and to double down and try to find funding harder. But it, without that threat of litigation, I'm concerned that private industrial forest land reform work is always going to be frustrated because, you know, we're not only going up against the timber companies who are well-funded and have staff that they can devote solely towards government affairs issues, but we're also going up against the Board of Forestry, which is composed of folks who are sympathetic to the timber industry and to CAL FIRE, which is kind of a revolving door between the timber industry and government.
One thought, Tom, might be that maybe what we need to do is retrench into pivoting toward another branch of government now and working more toward the legislative branch again, because, as you know, during the time when we had Wes Chesbrough in there, he was pretty much a champion for timber policy that we would like. Off and on, at least, he was. And we haven't got a champion in the legislature right now. There's a vacuum there. We know who should be stepping up. We're trying to get them to do so. But it seems to me that maybe one outlet we have right now for getting this thing going forward may not be the courts, but maybe putting a little more pressure on the politicians who have are in a position to do something about this, and really make them feel more heat, because these things matter to their constituents, to their economies, and we've seen timber companies evolve, as you know, away from producing big, healthy sawlogs to producing what Richard Wilson, the director of CAL FIRE from 91 to 98, calls the pencil factory production on lumber yards now. And we have carbon issues that are encroaching now. Water and wildfire are huge public policy issues, and we need to have these politicians be responsive to forest protection, cumulative watershed effects, too, from the vantage point of these big hot-button issues that are hitting right now. We need things to get done in the legislature and not just going out and doing thinning projects, but, you know, recruiting more big trees onto the landscape, which are great for reducing wildfire hazard and risk, and for increasing salmon habitat and for increasing quality and quantity of water. All those things are very topical right now, and we think that while the avenues that we have available in litigation may be regrouping, maybe there's an opportunity now for us to really move aggressively in the legislative front.
All right, Paul. I have Richard Ginger now on the phone. Hey, Richard, how's it going?
Hey, not too bad. I've been enjoying Paul's recap and a lot of real strong validity that people really need to pay attention to. I would say that the Environmental Quality Act was a major factor in the requirement to consider cumulative impacts. And from my perspective, with the fisheries and all that the pilot project was not just to try and get an improvement in the cumulative impacts process, but to facilitate watershed restoration, because foresters are required to walk every stream in their harvest plan and bring back information about adverse impacts, landslides, bank failures, riparian conditions, and all that. And there's so much that's been shined on for so long to deal with these legacy problems that's really key. And that fits in, too, with all this funding that's going on about thinning and prescribed fire. Supposedly it's supposed to deal with watershed restoration as well. There's so many disconnects, and the public, ever since the so-called resolution of old growth issues, the headwaters, of course, was a huge part of that, has really not kept up in their own interest economically and environmentally in these venues with private harvest and reform. You know, there's so much that still is impactful that's not being dealt with and should be, and it will help local economies and the environment and the future.
And I want to second what Paul had to say about the kind of changing face, perhaps, of concerns that are marketable to government agencies and to legislators, with carbon and fire being foremost in mind. Those are absolutely issues that are on the lips of every legislator down in Sacramento. One of our challenges is, of course, and this has been a problem that we've had with the timber industry for a long time, is the actual science versus the timber science. And I think that
when you talk about that, Tom,
what's that?
They get upset when you talk about timber science.
Oh, yeah. No, I understand.
Concerned, it is the science, you know, and everything else is discredited. It's incredible.
Yeah, and so the timber industry has done a very good job, honestly, at putting forward a case that, you know, the carbon smart thing to do is to log, because we can put that woody biomass into long-lived forest products. And yeah, if we don't log, then, you know, it's going to burn up in the next fire and going to turn to black carbon in the atmosphere, and everything is worse off.
It's really sick. It really is sick, because houses and furniture do not absorb carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
You know, and real forest and real quality, and that's, I'll get off here in a moment here, but two of the things, and Paul hit on some of them, is there needs to be standards for what a healthy forest is, which has a large proportion of larger, older trees. And there needs to be incentives for people to really get there. And Jackson Demonstration State Forest is one of the things that why forests matter and forests forever keep coming back to as an example of one of the healthiest forests we got in our region. And so I got 50,000 board feet per acre, and normal industry stuff is like, say, 20,000. You know, it's got multiple use in terms of recreation and all these other benefits with fisheries, and we need to duplicate that and do it again all over the region so that we actually have something in the future for our future generations.
Absolutely. Well, Paul and Richard, thank you so much for joining us here on the Environment Show on KMUD.
Thanks a million, Tom. We're a pleasure.
All right. So if you want to check out more from Forest Forever, you can go to their website at forestforever.org. Again, I really respect the heck out of both Paul and Richard, and they have been wonderful allies and parts of EPIC throughout our history. So I really appreciate getting to work with them on private industrial forest issues. Coming up next on the show, we're going to talk to Don Lipmanson about wildlife services. Don, are you on the line?
Yes, good evening, Tom.
Hi, Don. It's nice to hear from you. So Wildlife Services is kind of a funny, it has a funny name for an agency that kills wildlife. Can you describe just what the heck this agency actually is?
Oh, this outfit's been around for about a century now, and it's a branch of the United States Department of Agriculture that is basically designed to the desires of a section of the ranching community and the farming community that thinks that views wildlife as their enemies or the things that kill their livestock. And USDA gets a ton of gets a ton of taxpayer money that serves a very small segment of the community. They do in Mendocino County, where we're like up in Humboldt County. You have a live issue with them down in Mendocino County, the same thing. And in Mendocino County, as I believe up in Humboldt County, they also get involved in the in trapping and generally killing a raccoon or skunk or an opossum when it gets in your attic or your up in your ceiling, say.
Yeah, so up here in Humboldt County, how it traditionally works is we will have a homeowner, and they'll give a call to the county, and they'll say, oh, you know, I have this raccoon. He's gotten into my crawl space, and can you send somebody out here to deal with him? And what will happen is that then the county ag commissioner will call up the local trapper associated with Wildlife Services, and they'll go out. And, you know, maybe they will tell the person, you know, to stop raccoons, you should put a gate over that crawl space or whatever. But they may not. They may just go out there and trap and kill that raccoon. And this is all done with taxpayer money. So Humboldt County, I believe, spent about $70,000 last year to contract with Wildlife Services to provide this service to the community. And so it makes folks like myself just incredibly mad to pay taxes to pay somebody to go out and kill wildlife. And Don, I think you probably feel similarly.
Yes, in Mendocino County, however, what the county spends for wildlife services is twice that $70,000. It was actually $144,000 a year or two ago, and now the projection that they're intending to spend is $177,000 a year to deal with supposed problems. Now, we're not saying that that these conflicts are always pleasant to deal with, but by and large, they can be dealt with in a way that involves excluding wildlife or deterring wildlife from coming to the area that you want to protect. And it doesn't require that they be killed. killing is just sort of viewed as the easiest and definitely the traditional way of dealing with things. And as wildlife declines in numbers, not obviously for rats or perhaps for raccoons and skunks, but the predators, for instance, their numbers are definitely in decline worldwide. And to just keep on killing them in order to preserve some tradition that developed back when, largely I think much of it dates from that dominion that humanity would have dominion over the rest of the animals, which, you know, that's that doctrine goes back about 5,000 years, 4,000 years or so, and it's we believe it's time to move on and view wildlife as a critical part of ecosystems and also creatures that deserve compassion, just like humans need a touch of compassion, especially these days.
So thankfully, there's work to be done, or there is work being done to confront wildlife services and to hopefully change the political reception that the agency gets from local governments, and to force local governments to reconsider their contracts with wildlife services. And this is a coalition that is statewide and involves big national players and small regional players. And Don is part of this coalition work. And part of this work has been focused on Mendocino County. So, Don, can you tell us what has gone on in the past in Mendocino County to try to change course there?
All right, back around 2013, 2014, a coalition addressed this for the first time. People concerned for animal welfare and for wild habitats and for nature got together and threatened to sue the county if they didn't do an environmental impact report on the effect of the Wildlife Service killing of predators. The county did a negative declaration, no need for an EIR. This has been bouncing back and forth in court for about 4 years. Then in 2017 or thereabouts, the county committed, rather than being sued and having to spend money to defend yet again, they agreed to do an EIR, Environmental Impact Report. That report was completed mid-2018. There were hearings held about it, and then a final Environmental Impact Report, along with a proposal to renew the old what's called Integrated Wildlife Damage Management Program run by Wildlife Services, was reintroduced as the county's preferred option. There was a vote of the Board of Supervisors on December 17th, and unfortunately, by a 3-2 margin, the board voted to approve the EIR and to resume its Integrated Wildlife Damage Lethal Program. Now, they had not yet signed a contract with Wildlife Services. I'm going to announce now, I think for the first time, that we are going to file, some of us, it's a small portion of that large coalition that you described, but the local group that was organized ad hoc to try and get the county to change its ways is going to be filing a CEQA suit to get the EIR rescinded and to come up with a program that is almost entirely non-lethal and that would not be operated by Wildlife Services but would rather be operated by either a county agency like Animal Care and Control and, quite promisingly, for smaller mammals, by a private non-profit organization that perhaps Sonoma Wildlife Rescue will assist Mendocino County residents in setting up. That will generate a few jobs for local people, and it'll give, if we get what we want, it will give the County Board of Supervisors direct oversight over the way that the wildlife management program is administered, having to defer always to the standards of the federal government, which these days, frankly, tend to be pretty abusive. I know they're talking a big game about how, oh, their wildlife services, that is, how they're moving towards non-lethal, et cetera, but we have yet to see any evidence or proof of that, whereas we have plenty of evidence of wildlife service killing hundreds and hundreds of coyotes in Mendocino County per year, quite a few bobcats, quite a few bears. That's in the dozens and dozens of bobcats and bears, and most alarmingly, a lot of cougars, or I shouldn't say a fair number of cougars whose populations are in serious decline in Mendocino County, as the DEIR itself indicates.
So Mendocino County is the tip of the spear in the fight against wildlife services. And Don, you're part of that vanguard party that is leading the charge. And, you know, I believe that votes should have consequences. So can you let us know who are the Mendocino County supervisors who voted in favor of accepting the EIR for wildlife services?
Yes. Unsurprisingly, Supervisor Carrie Brown, who was for many years the executive director of the Mendocino County Farm Bureau, but who is not running for office again. And I should add that the Farm Bureau is probably the major driving factor nationwide in the support of wildlife services. Also, Supervisor John McCowan, who as well is not going to be running for re-election. Most interestingly is that the third supervisor who supported it and whom we had hoped would be the swing vote, Dan Jurdy, voted both to adopt the EIR and to adopt the Integrated Wildlife Damage Program. And he is running for re-election, as is one opponent, Lindy Peters. And I implore 4th District listeners, Mendocino County 4th District listeners, primarily Fort Bragg, to attend a League of Women Voters forum on this coming Thursday at 6:30 to 8 o'clock at the Fort Bragg Town Hall, where I'm pretty confident that each candidate is going to be asked whether they will make a commitment to a non-lethal program if they are reelected.
And I know that this is cold comfort, but everyone else in the state who is working on wildlife services issues is so thankful for the work that people have done in Mendocino County, because you have helped to scare other counties away from wildlife services. So, you know, this is an effort. I think it is fair to describe as a one-by-one county effort, whereby an environmental coalition will approach a county and demand for them to end their contract with wildlife services. And I think that because of all the headache that you have given Mendocino County, other counties are far more likely to seriously consider whether or not they want to test the environmental community. So thank you for that. Although I should say that counties have pulled other hijinks. So for example, in Siskiyou County, where they were threatened with a lawsuit, they dropped their contract with wildlife services, but then they separately contracted with the same trapper to provide the same services, but just not to use the wildlife services moniker. So hijinks and hinky things have occurred still, but it is part of a larger campaign to get rid of this antiquated agency. So Don, any more thoughts, any last thoughts about wildlife services and the future of the agency in California or in Mendocino County?
Yes, well, I'd like to turn momentarily to Humboldt, where you and the coalition seem to be having some success in negotiating some real change. It may be, I don't know the constitution of your borders or the composition of your board of supervisors or your ag department, but it may be that those folks are a little bit more reasonable than what we're seeing down here in Mendocino County. I must say that Sonoma County is ripe for this sort of intervention as well, because they did precisely what you're describing was done up in Siskiyou, or was it Shasta, where they just contracted the same people. Now, the counties can do that, but then they would have the option of imposing stricter rules than against the excessive killing of wildlife, which Wildlife Services seems incapable or unwilling to do right now. But there are successes happening here and there. Marin had a considerable success, although the opponents always want to dispute the facts on the ground. But certainly there is less killing, despite some efforts to claim the contrary in Marin than there used to be when Wildlife Services was operating. So, indeed, county by county, and I think that one of the lessons that comes away from this is that we all want people who want to change Wildlife Services at a county level need to give some pretty careful consideration to the makeup of the Board of Supervisors and the political forces underlying that board to see whether it's what approach is most worthwhile and what approach just isn't going to get you anywhere.
And so you mentioned an effort underway here in Humboldt County, and I haven't said much about it publicly yet because hopefully we'll have big news coming soon, but we are in talks with the county about their contract with Wildlife Services. And I would like to thank Ag Commissioner Jeff Dolph right now because he has been open to change with the Wildlife Services contract and to rethink the way that we can provide services for citizens to deal with interactions with wildlife, which are less than ideal. You know, no one likes to have a skunk living under their house, but we can deal with those in a more humane way that doesn't result in animal deaths, and we can reduce total animal deaths by doing better work. So hopefully something soon will come there, and K-Mud, I'll be the first to let you know if that does happen. Don, thank you so much for joining the show tonight, and thank you for all your work to combat Wildlife Services. You are one of my heroes.
Oh, thank you. And likewise, Tom, I appreciate everything that you're doing up there, and I hope that the Humboldt residents will rally to to your cause.
All right. So, listeners, head out to that Fort Bragg League of Women Voters event and continue to put the pressure on your local elected officials to do something about Wildlife Services. So I believe I have Regina on the line. Regina, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Hey, Regina, give us a little intro. Tell us about yourself.
Well, my name is Regina Chigazola. I am the co-director of Save California Salmon. And I'm also a policy analyst for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. And Save California Salmon works to bring people into water quality and water flows decision and make sure that people who depend on fish and salmon are people who are listened to in the water debates. We're very committed to bringing back salmon, bringing back other fisheries, and making sure that people have access to clean water. And the areas that we are focused on are the Klamath, the Trinity, the Eel River, the Upper Sacramento River, the San Joaquin, and the North Coast.
And
the Smith River. Sorry.
Regina is just a fantastic activist, and I am so impressed by your ability to give disadvantaged communities, tribal communities, rural communities, a platform and a voice to let decision makers know that these water withdrawals and these bad water deals hurt their communities. So thank you for all your work there. I don't really pay a whole lot of attention to water stuff, admittedly. I am focused on forested ecosystems, so I'm a bit out of the loop. Can you catch me up on the top things that are going on right now affecting North Coast water?
Yeah, it's almost hard to know where to start. There's so much, unfortunately. But I'm going to focus right now on California water policy and the Trinity River, because those are the areas that where we are really dealing with the impacts of the Trump administration and really bad water policy. So a lot of the things that are going on right now, for people who don't know, the Trump administration put a lobbyist for the Wetlands Water District, which is the most powerful water entity in California and the nation. A lobbyist for both him and oil companies are now in charge of the Department of Interior, and they make most of the water decisions and a lot of the land decisions within the United States. And they're also in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So they're definitely a very powerful agency. And so the person who's in charge there, his name is David Bernhard, and he is a lobbyist for big oil and big agriculture before he had this job. And he promised his friends in California Water that they were going to get everything they want, and Donald Trump said that he felt like any water hit in the ocean was a waste of water, and water should stop being diverted into the ocean, is kind of how he put it. So we had Trump put out a water plan for the Central Valley Project, which is both a state and federal water diversion project. And the Trinity River, the largest tributary to the Klamath River, is diverted into the Central Valley Project. And the rest of the watersheds that go in there all feed either the San Joaquin, Sacramento River, San Francisco Bay, or Bay Delta. So he put out a new water plan to give farmers about 22% more water from that entire project, including the Trinity River. And then the biological opinion put out by endangered species agencies said that that was going to put most of the fishery species in the Bay Delta watershed in Sacramento into jeopardy, meaning they could go extinct. And so what they did is they suppressed that report and made the agencies do a new report saying the salmon would not go extinct, which is very similar to the situation that led to the Klamath fish kill. And so that Trump water plan is out. The biological opinion has been approved, and now that's going into the litigation stages. And so in the meanwhile, the governor of California said he was going to litigate against that and not let Trump force California fisheries into extinction. However, it seems like he's backing up again from that because of threats from the Westlands Water District. And he put out his own water plan for the project, which also takes much more water out of the watersheds that are involved. And also, he recently, just this week, put out the governor's water portfolio, which very much focuses on turning the twin-tunnel proposal in the Bay Delta to a one-tunnel proposal. And that's a proposal to divert a lot of water out of the Sacramento system. But the way this affects us, and he also wanted to make sure that Sites Reservoir is built, which is a large new reservoir which would be built directly off of the Sacramento River and involved a whole lot more water diversions. And so the way this affects us, though, is because the Trinity River is diverted through a series of dams into the Sacramento River system. And we are putting a lot of energy right now into doing independent hydrology reports. And what we're coming back with is a report saying the site's reservoir is going to impact Trinity River temperatures and salmon in the Trinity River. And now we have a new one that might come out very shortly once it's reviewed by all the scientists saying that Trinity River carryover storage is not protected through the Trump water plans. And so recently, I know this is a lot of information and I can answer questions, but recently, largely to tribal activists and also youth activists and these science reports, the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors passed a resolution saying that they would not support the Sites Reservoir Project unless they redid their environmental documentation and in their water rights guaranteed there would not be impacts to the Trinity River or Humboldt County's reserved water rights to that river that they choose to use for flows into the Klamath River. So that right after that happened, the governor released his water portfolio saying that that's his top priority and that it should be fast-tracked and possibly even exempt from environmental review. And this reservoir is about a third of the size of Shasta Reservoir. It's not a small project. It's a very large project that's going to involve diverting a lot more water out of our rivers. So, of course, we are opposed to that. There's a public comment period right now on the governor's water portfolio, and I believe the comment date is going to be February 6th or 7th. And also, one of the issues with that is the governor had listening sessions on what he should do with California throughout California, supposedly, but in the north part of the state, the only hearing was in Yreka. The north coast did not get a chance to give input on that. So I think it's an important way that people can get involved is to comment and let the governor know that, the salmon species, both in the Klamath and in the Sacramento, are going down so quickly that there's barely even commercial fishing seasons anymore. And we're looking at possible near extinction, and this isn't even looking at the impacts of climate change. It's just under what's happened in the past. So we can't afford to give up a lot more water in our systems. They're already really suffering. What we need to be doing is restoring our water systems and making sure that we have clean water that can be used by fish and people. And so we're pretty disappointed in the governor right now. It seems like he's pretty much on the same page as Trump on water issues.
And this is a governor who said, you know, one of his top priorities is going to be pushing back on Trump's anti-environmental regime. And so for him to do this, for him to veto SB1, which would have provided safeguards if Trump tried to roll back federal environmental laws, it's just incredibly disappointing. But thankfully, he is an elected official, and I'm sure he is concerned about his poll numbers, as any elected official is. So he is, you know, there's hope yet. And we have a large voice here on the North Coast when we get excited about something. So you mentioned that there is a public comment period coming up. Is there a place where people could go to sign on to comments or to help get inspiration to write their own comments?
Yeah, we're going to have an action alert up within days on Save California Salmon's website, which is californiasalmon.org. We also have a Facebook page called Save California Salmon, and we have a Twitter page, we have Instagram, so there will be a lot of action alerts on this, and the only reason we don't have it up so far is because all those other things I mentioned, they all had comment periods over the holiday season, too, but probably by the end of the week, there will be action alerts, and we will make sure to get it into as much of the local media as possible. Especially because people were, I think, pretty excited that the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors stood up for the Trinity River and against the site's reservoir. So having the governor not only not listen to Humboldt County on this issue, but pretty much go against their recommendations by moving away from environmental review is something that is pretty disappointing. But like you said, we have a strong voice on the North Coast. I've seen very few communities more willing to fight for their salmon and for their clean water.
Well, so I look to you, to the tribes, and to the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations as leaders here. So I will make a pledge that on behalf of EPIC, when your petitions are up, we will make sure that we are linked to them as well so that folks will know where to go. So be on the lookout for that coming up soon. We have a February deadline. So is there anything else you want to share in the next minute or so going on in California water politics, water issues that listeners should know about?
Well, there's two other issues possibly. One is there is already a petition up to the governor asking him to not back down from his stance to sue the Trump administration on the Trump water plan. So people can get on that petition right now by going to our website. They can also contact me directly and ask to be on the California Salmon News email list. We always include action alerts on all of these things. We're deeply committed to making sure that people know what's going on. There's also a comment period that just ended on some permanent water contracts to take water out of our rivers, including one for Bernhard's buddies, the Westland Area Water District. So, there are a lot of opportunities to get involved, and we are also committed to making sure that people who are wanting to fight for their watersheds get the support they need to do that. And we are working also on Eel River Dam removal, Klamath Dam removal, Smith River lily bulb issues, making sure that the governor deals with climate change in a way that makes sure our watersheds stay safe and that salmon can access cold water tributaries and habitat. Get a hold of us, get involved. We'll do everything we can in our power to make sure that the community gets the support they need to fight for the salmon and to fight for clean water, because right now the North State is not very represented, and I think there's a real David versus Goliath situation going on where people see that we still have access to clean water, and the powers that be want that. They want the clean water, and they're willing to fight for it, so we need to be willing to fight back.
All right. Well, thank you, Regina. And give us your website one more time.
It's californiasalmon.org or Save California Salmon on Facebook. And you can message us, and my email address is regina@californiasalmon.org. And we have people who work in the Smith River, Eel River, Trinity, and Klamath Rivers, and in the northern Sacramento watershed. So.
All right. Thank you, Regina, for joining us. And as we end the show, just a reminder that on February 5th, the Axon Orchestra is going to play a benefit show for Epic at the Arcata Playhouse Theater. That is from 7:30 to 10 p.m. Doors at 6:30. And there will be a dinner of hearty soup, salad, and locally baked bread. All drink proceeds will go to Epic, and tickets are sliding scale at the door, and no one will be turned away. So I hope to see you there. I hope to see you with your dancing shoes on. Come out in support of Epic. Thank you, K-Mud, for another great environment.